It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. While political leaders from around the world gathered last week for the annual United Nations General Assembly Forum, government, corporate, and nonprofit officials also went to New York for the UN Climate Action Summit. Among them was Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto, who is the North American representative on the Global Covenant of Mayors for Climate and Energy. I spoke with him in his office this week. Mayor Peduto, welcome back to the Confluence.
Thank you.
Speeches by world leaders mentioned the border wall, the Iran nuclear deal, instability in Venezuela. Do you think the Climate Action Summit got overshadowed by the other global, the General Assembly gathering?
Well, that was the purpose of the meeting once a year in New York, and it becomes a stage, each leader being given about 3 minutes to address any of the topics of the world. There was a special emphasis, though, this year on the role of nations in climate change, but there was a different focus than what has ever happened before at a United Nations meeting. The United Nations has always looked at issues from a national level, but this time was the first time that it began to invite those that are actually implementing change at a local level to the table.
But do you think that finger pointing on other issues, important as they are, did overshadow or not? Did you get the attention you thought you might get?
Yeah, the issues did come up, but there is no doubt that climate change was front and foremost of not only what was being spoken on the floor of the General Assembly, but in the thousands of meetings that were occurring all throughout New York.
You represented U.S. mayors at the 2018 Climate Summit in Poland. What, if anything, was different this year in New York? Messaging, attitudes, something else?
Yeah, so I've been at a few now, and in Paris was the most comparable to what this was like. At Paris, there were 500 mayors who gathered. It was the largest gathering of mayors in the Earth's history, and it basically set the way for a treaty, because what was said was, we've already got this. It's going to need to be implemented on a local basis, and we are already in the implementation mode. No matter what the treaty agreement is, we're going to be able to work to deliver it. That's much like the conversation that was occurring in New York, only it has now reached out into the corporate world as well. In Poland, it was more of a technocrat ability to measure what is being measured, science behind the measurement, and really getting into the minutiae of the detail of the treaty.
Is it fair to say that there weren't many solid promises or commitments at the national level that were made last week? I mean, China nor the U.S. made any commitments at the national level, for example.
Yeah, there were a few commitments that individual nations made, which were mainly around financial obligations that they were willing to take on. There was more of a call of the wealthiest nations to take on more responsibility for the poorer nations. But there was more, I would say, platitude than actual conversation, agreement, or discussion beyond specific initiatives being done on a country-by-country basis.
Efforts in our country seem to be happening more at the grassroots level, the municipal level, if you would. Is the bigger challenge getting the national stakeholders on board, or do you even need it at the national level? Do you think there's enough groundswell to take care of this?
It's interesting, because we had a very interesting conversation with leaders of the World Economic Forum. There were probably 30 people in the room that represented manufacturers, the engineering, world bankers. And in that conversation, there was very little that was discussed on national treaties. It was more of a discussion on, number one, infrastructure can be invested in. Number two, what those structures will look like and the need to be more creative than we have in the past. Number three, that the old models of privatization or the rating of the potential revenue of infrastructure is not a policy that is supported on a global basis. And number four, that a lot of these initiatives, if not all of them, are basically under the purview of local governments. Obviously, it's an entirely different world when then discussing it with third world nations, where local governments don't exist, or if they do exist, they are bankrupt or void of being able to make that type of investment. But when looking at the Western world, looking at Asia, looking at the developed world, it really does come down to the local government.
Our guest on The Confluence is Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto, who spoke at last week's UN Climate Action Summit. Greta Thunberg, a 16-year-old Swedish climate activist who has gained worldwide renown, had a message for world leaders. Quote, if you choose to fail us, I say we will never forgive you. Do you think it's going to be up to the younger generations to seriously address the issue of climate change? And are you seeing any of that determination among young people in the Pittsburgh area?
The determination of young people, number one, on a global basis is phenomenal. And for those that haven't been paying attention to it, it is on every continent on Earth, and they are actually working together. In Pittsburgh, we have great leadership that is coming from teenagers, from preteens, and especially from our college students. And the Earth and the preservation of it by addressing climate change is one of the two major issues that they have taken the leadership on. There is no doubt in this country that the next generation of Americans have made their top two issues dealing with climate change and addressing it so that they have a planet for themselves and their children. And their 9/11 has become school shootings and addressing the gun safety issues as well. They've made more than their voices heard. They've made their leadership known.
What impresses you about young folks and their maybe determination regarding addressing climate change?
Well, one of the things that impresses me but also becomes part of the more difficulty is the insistence on the strongest type of action to happen immediately. And when I say that, it's not that I take away nor dismiss their reality of where we are and what we need to do. When you're dealing with this issue, you're dealing with much more than just the infrastructure that exists today, but building the infrastructure to be able to do the things that they want for tomorrow. And just like building a highway structure through two decades, we need to do the same thing on the infrastructure of being able to create renewable energy as the primary source of energy over the next 20 years. And that will take 20 years. Understand that any Green New Deal has to put people first, and we should look at the people that are being left behind in the new economy and be able to make sure that they have a place in the rebuilding of the infrastructure that will be needed in order to do the things young people want. But you can't do all of that instantaneously. It's a series of building that foundation in order to build upon it and then to build that world that they want to see. And that takes time. And I think sometimes younger voices are, I'm guilty of the same thing, a little impatient in waiting because they realize the severity of the problem and they don't believe that we have time.
One of the panels you spoke on in New York focused on Pittsburgh's role in advancing the UN Sustainable Development Goals. There are 17 such goals. Are there one or two where you think the city, along with the partners, are already making some progress?
It's interesting to note that in the United States today, there's only one city that has adopted the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, and that's the city of New York. New York City has decided that all 17 of the UN SDGs are the very principles by which they will govern. We are committed to adopt the UN SDGs, and it is my goal to be able to do so, all 17 of them, this month.
This month. What would that require?
Well, it would require that basically our one PGH plan that we've been working on with the universities and the hospitals would be able to reflect the needs of the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, and that the projects which we would do around that plan would be able to meet the objects of that. Ending hunger, working on gender equity and ending discrimination against women in all forms, being able to create a much greener planet that has its strategic missions around the goals of sustainability recognized. And all 17 initiatives would have to be reflected in projects, and that we would then work with the universities and the hospitals and our corporate community in order to be able to address them.
Where's this city, where's this region falling short in terms of sustainable goals or in climate action toward climate change?
I think that the biggest issues for us remain our infrastructure and our investment in people. On our infrastructure side, we have come so far in cleaning our air, yet we are so far behind other areas still. And we can identify the key areas of pollution in our city and in our region and be able to identify the exact source of that pollution, but we haven't done enough in order to be able to reduce it. In our infrastructure, we can identify where our disinvestment over decades in our water system has come to a cost that we now are paying. And we do have a plan that will remove every lead pipe out of our system by 2025. I think if we start addressing those two key areas, the basics, air and water, we have an opportunity over this next decade to build a much more sustainable city for the next 50 years.
Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, citizens gather at First Presbyterian Church to form the Pittsburgh Colonization Society in 1826. The group was a local branch of a federal society that aimed to return all enslaved people at the time to their native countries in Africa. The gathering was a reaction to recent cases of slave owners trying to kidnap free slaves in Pittsburgh and other parts of the North. But throughout most of the country, free black slaves did not like the society, saying it respected the institution of slavery, whereas the better thing to do would oppose and abolish it completely. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
Imagine being able to eat fresh local produce anytime, even in winter. It's already happening thanks to a local consumer tech company that runs a vertical farm. I'm Maria Scappellato with the Pittsburgh Business Report on 90.5 WESA. Fifth Season, founded 3 years ago as Robotany, has taken root in Pittsburgh. The company uses proprietary robotics technology to grow plants hydroponically indoors. At a vertical farm, plants are stacked high on shelves. LED lighting replicates the sun in a pesticide-free, controlled environment. CEO and co-founder Austin Webb tells me what they're growing.
We're growing spring mixes, any kind of salad mix. You can think of spinach, arugula, kale, basil, cilantro, dill, you name it. And honestly, that's just the start. There's a lot of other crops and other vegetables that we can grow. And so leafy greens and herbs is really just our start, and we'll keep going from there.
You're going to be moving into a bigger space soon in Braddock, a commercial scale operation. How much do you think you'll be able to produce, say, in the next year or two?
Yeah, we're super excited about joining and engaging with the Braddock community. We've been really warmly receptive there, and we're excited to be opening up our newest commercial scale farm, which will be opening in early 2020 in Braddock. When we get to full scale operation, we'll be producing over 500,000 pounds of produce per year. And it really is a new standard because we've created this unique design. It's a never before seen vertical farm. And unlike the industry-wide struggle to make economics work, which is why vertical farming hasn't really been able to expand its impact yet, we've been really hard at work over the last 3 years to make it a scalable, profitable, repeatable platform that, again, at affordable prices for retailers, restaurants, and consumers alike. So finally, right here in Braddock, right here in Pittsburgh, vertical farming can finally take off with this season.
So will you be growing your workforce as well?
Absolutely, yes. So we'll be our company will be doubling when we open up the new farm. And then from there, we will continue to add on many folks in Braddock and our headquarters in the South Side. And then as we take what we built in Pittsburgh and expand that impact to more farms in the Pittsburgh area, but also cities throughout the U.S., we'll be growing extremely quickly. And people are an important part of that.
So is this product or these greens affordable for the average consumer that goes to the grocery store?
Absolutely. We don't have any kind of premium on our product that makes anything unaffordable. Everything is at the prices that people currently buy today. And we've been really hard at work to make everything extremely economical in our farms. And so over time, we don't really see the need for people to have to spend an arm and a leg just to get healthy food. And to be honest with you, we're able to actually not just create affordable produce if that's sort of hey, it's Monday, I need to go get affordable produce for the week. We can also do things, customized growing for really high experiences. And so we can really do both at the same time. We don't have to pick and choose. And so we can really focus on yield and quality or focus on them separately depending on what people need or what they're looking for.
And where can people find your products locally?
So when we open up our new farm in Braddock in early 2020, we'll be able to find our product in Giant Eagle Market District, Whole Foods, and then restaurants like Superior Motors, Kevin Sousa in Braddock, a good friend of ours, Honeygrow in East Liberty, Kahuna in East Liberty, you name it.
Fifth Season was incubated at Carnegie Mellon University's Swartz Center for Entrepreneurship. The company's raised $35 million to date and is planning to expand to additional vertical farms nationwide. In business news headlines, a grand opening was held this week for the Rivers Casino's new sports book called Bet Rivers. The 5,500 square foot space includes 33 self-service betting kiosks and 6 betting windows. It opened just in time to allow Steelers fans to wager on Monday night's game against the Bengals, which the Steelers won 27-3. And starting this week, customers to local craft brew pubs will see a slight state sales tax increase, roughly 10 cents per pint of beer. That's the Pittsburgh Business Report on 90.5 WESA.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Half of the land area of Pennsylvania drains into the Chesapeake Bay, and that includes pollution from agricultural runoff and sewage overflows. Maryland's governor has criticized Pennsylvania for not spending enough to clean up the bay. For State Impact Pennsylvania, Kara Holsoppel reports some Pittsburgh restaurants are recycling oyster shells to improve water quality in the bay.
Jessica Lewis says shucking an oyster is like picking a lock.
You press down and then you just wiggle, pop it open. The abductor muscle right there, you clean that.
Lewis is the executive chef of Spirits and Tales at the Oaklander Hotel in Pittsburgh. She runs a small knife around the sides of a closed oyster shell.
You can't really muscle through it. You clean under it and see all that liquor? This one's got a lot of liquor in it.
That's the salty ocean water still inside the shell, and it makes the oyster slide out smoothly into your mouth.
That's perfect. I'm gonna take this one right here.
Lewis says they go through about 300 to 400 oysters here a week from the east and west coasts. This oyster is from Maryland's Chesapeake Bay, and its top and bottom shell are going back there. Lewis and her staff toss the spent shells in a 35-gallon barrel with a screw-on lid. It's located in the trash area on the ground floor of the building.
So nobody likes to recycle the oyster shells because there's flies everywhere and it's nasty. Gross. So we're doing something good. Let's get out of here.
About once a month, a truck picks up the old shells from this and 6 other participating restaurants in Pittsburgh and drives them more than 250 miles to a staging area just across the Chesapeake Bay Bridge in Maryland. From there, the oyster shells from Pittsburgh and ones collected from Maryland, Virginia, and the D.C. area are taken to a site at the University of Maryland's Horn Point Laboratory in Cambridge for processing.
So here you're looking at about 7,000 tons of clean shell.
Karis King is with Oyster Recovery Partnership, a nonprofit which works to increase oyster numbers in the Chesapeake Bay. We're standing at the base of a mountain of gray shells. They've been dumped into a machine that's like a modified potato hopper, which sorts the shells, and washed with water from the nearby Choptank River, a major tributary of the bay. Smaller fragments of broken shell fall away as a conveyor belt deposits the half shells into wire cages or piles, where they're cured for a year. Then they're ready to go on to the next phase of the recycling chain.
Even with, you know, all of the shell that we do recycle and that we also purchase some from shucking houses, we still don't have enough to do large-scale restoration at the rate that we could.
That's because of the scale of the problem. Stephanie Alexander manages the Horn Point Lab Oyster Hatchery.
When John Smith sailed up in the 1600s, he was running aground on the oysters.
Alexander says that's before these waters were over-harvested, before there was agricultural runoff and soil erosion from development.
We've pretty much wiped the oyster out to less than 1% of historic levels. So we started this restoration effort where we're using a hatchery to produce spat-on-shell to put back into the bay so we can kind of help jumpstart Mother Nature.
The concept is pretty simple. Scientists here at the lab produce baby oysters from adults harvested from the bay, nurture the microscopic larvae with a custom algae diet, then get them to attach to the recycled treated oyster shells. That's the spat on shell. In practice, it's a lot harder than it sounds. Ben Malmgren is an intern here, a student from St. Mary's College of Maryland.
Right now, we're placing the oysters out on the spawning table where we are going to simulate river conditions that are ideal for spawning.
The saltiness and temperature of the water in the shallow black basins has to be just right. Malmgren places the oysters in a grid formation, so it's easier to separate the males from the females.
Because if we just let them spawn out on the table, all these eggs are going to go down to into the drain. So once we see a female, and we'll know she's a female by she'll clap her top and bottom shell together, and it'll see a plume of eggs come out. It'll kind of look like Splenda, like in a cup of coffee.
Then he'll pull the females off the table, where they'll continue to spawn in a tub. Those eggs will be fertilized with the sperm collected from the male oysters. But the oysters aren't cooperating today. Left to their own devices, it could take hours.
It's a lot like just watching a pile of rocks, but it can be exciting when they all start going.
Even in the lab, nature is in charge. Stephanie Alexander says it was a slow summer. A lot of rain meant the adult oysters have lived with lower salinity levels, and they're stressed. Out in the bay, the water is warmer, meaning the spat on shell might have a harder time growing that second shell, and over the years, forming the clusters that create oyster reefs.
When one thing gets out of whack, everything else is going to kind of follow. So we're trying to get the oysters back into balance, so then hopefully everything else will follow as well.
Over the last two decades, the Lab and Oyster Recovery Partnership have planted over 8 billion oysters on the bottom of the Chesapeake Bay and its tributaries, with the help of other partners like the Maryland Department of Natural Resources and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Throughout the summer, spat-on-shell are released from a boat on sites where they're most likely to survive. And Alexander says that's critical.
Oysters are the vacuum cleaners or the kidneys of the bay, and they just suck the water in. They decide if it's food or not food, but no matter what it is, they'll remove it from the water column, and that's how they vacuum the bay up and clean it.
Because of this superpower, oyster aquaculture is a best management practice, identified by the regional partnership that oversees cleaning up the Chesapeake Bay. Some of the spat raised at the Horn Point Lab will make its way to oyster farmers, and those are the oysters on a half shell that are served in restaurants. But the majority of the spat will help rebuild oyster reefs, creating habitat for fish and restoring the ecosystem. Back in Pittsburgh, Jessica Lewis is educating diners and trying to convince other Pittsburgh restaurants to join the oyster shell recycling effort that feeds the conservation work, to see the value in giving back.
With all this like climate change going on and all the scary things, it's like a bright light shining through and that we did something good.
Her pitch, every shell counts. Kara Holsapple, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The state Supreme Court has rejected a petition by two death row inmates to find that penalty unconstitutional. It's a request some advocates hoped would lead to a historic ruling, but instead left only an open door for a case-by-case review. WESA legal analyst David Harris teaches law at the University of Pittsburgh, and he joins us now. Good morning, David.
Good to be with you, Kevin.
The state Supreme Court case centered on a petition filed by two federal inmates, Jermont Cox of Philadelphia and Kevin Marinelli of Northumberland County, but had the potential to affect the approximately 130 others on death row. What was at stake here?
What was at stake was the constitutionality of the death penalty overall. So it wasn't about these two cases, which were very serious, of course. It was about all death penalty cases in the state. So the objective of these petitions was to get the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to rule that the system as a whole, the law as a whole, was unconstitutional, not just to rule in these two cases.
The defense wanted to appeal directly to the state Supreme Court, a so-called King's Bench jurisdiction.
That's right.
The justices basically said, play out your appeals in the lower courts?
The justices said, we're not going to look at the larger question of whether the statute is unconstitutional. We're going to hear any and all appeals that are appropriate at the level of each case. So bring your issues, bring your litigation, bring your cases. But we're uninterested at this point in this procedural posture in hearing something about all cases in the state. That was, as I said, the hope, but the Pennsylvania Supreme Court says no.
The state constitution bans cruel punishment. In the eyes of the court, is capital punishment cruel?
The court isn't saying one way or the other. What they are saying is they're not going to rule on that issue. Instead, they're going to rule only on issues raised by the individual cases. So many death row appeals find the initial verdicts being overturned. It's really an astoundingly high proportion over the decades, something like 70%. And because of that, there was a hope, along with a report that came out in 2018, that they could get the whole system thrown out. But that didn't happen, and the court said they don't want to be part of that.
Remind us, David, who gets sentenced to death, and by what means is it carried out in Pennsylvania when it is indeed carried out?
Well, who gets sentenced to death is one of the prime questions, because what we learn as we look over the entire pool of capital cases is that you tend to get death sentences for people who have the worst lawyers. Now, that sounds completely counterintuitive, but that is what turns out to happen. 70% of those cases, as I said, getting thrown out. And the one overwhelming set of factors is inadequate defense by defense counsel. That's, I think, an indefensible result. We simply can't support a system like that. And I think that's what the hope was, that the court would take advantage of that and go ahead.
And those defendants who you alluded to, poor, are often minority defendants as well.
They are often minority group members. The thing is that the stronger predictor than the race or ethnic group of the defendant is the race or ethnic group of the victim. And that is really a profound thing because, you know, it tends to tell you that the lives of victims are valued according to their race. At least that's the argument. And I don't think anybody wants a system like that.
Governor Wolf imposed a moratorium on executions in 2015. Did that work against the defendants here asking for an expedited consideration of the constitutionality of the death penalty because the Supreme Court said, well, there's no sense of urgency?
Well, not on its face. It wasn't one of the issues that was out front, and you wouldn't read it in the papers that were submitted to the court or in the arguments that were made. But certainly it is in the background that nobody is being executed now. I mean, and as long as the governor keeps the moratorium in place, there won't be any executions. So that could last throughout his administration and even into a next administration should the next governor agree.
David, the state court decided now is not the time, but they left the door open for the individual case-by-case reviews in the future. Could we see this question, this argument, come up again in the future as it makes its way up through the courts?
Absolutely, we could. Any individual case which presents the overall question, it will be fair game for the lawyers to raise the constitutionality of the state's death penalty system. The court is simply saying now, we're not about to take that question on as the case, as the issue in these two cases. Raise whatever other issues you have, and if an overall constitutional point comes up, that can be part of the package in any one case.
This decision by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court not to consider at this time got a lot of attention. Is the constitutionality of our death penalty here in Pennsylvania challenged often or not?
It hasn't been challenged often. It's been in place for a long time, since the 70s when the Supreme Court of the United States restored it. What made this case so unusual, among other things, was not just the challenge, but the fact that the Philadelphia DA's office actually sided with the two defendants who wanted the whole system overturned. You almost never see that. And of course, that's Larry Krasner, the still fairly new Philadelphia DA who came to office on a platform of deep criminal justice reform. And he was carrying out what he was elected to do.
Is he an opponent of the death penalty?
He is. He has a long record as an opponent of the death penalty. Interestingly, the state's attorney general's office, which was also involved in the case, came out on the other side. So you had leading law enforcement people on differing sides, which is, again, something that's very unusual.
If and when this question of the constitutionality of the death penalty in Pennsylvania makes its way to our highest court in the Commonwealth, what will be at the crux of a defense argument to negate the death penalty?
It will be the things that came up in that report I mentioned from 2018. The Joint Commission report basically said this is a bankrupt system, that defense counsel are poorly funded and don't do the job in an astounding number of these cases. It will be that kind of structural argument that eventually overturns it if it happens.
WESA legal analyst David Harris is a professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh, and he is host of the Criminal and Justice Podcast. David, thanks so much as always.
Good to be with you, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. When children grow up in poverty, everything suffers. Their prospects for education and future jobs, their likelihood of facing violence, incarceration, and diminished health. In Pittsburgh, lots of people and organizations are trying to help, but the solutions are complicated. Post-Gazette reporter Rich Lord is trying to bring a little clarity to the process, and he joins us from afar. Rich, thanks for making the time.
Pleasure to be here, Kevin.
Rich, you've reported a great deal this year about child poverty and all the ways kids and adults can fall through the cracks. You write, lots of people want to help. What's holding us back, though?
As a region, we have a ton of foundations, nonprofits, and government agencies that are working really hard on mitigating the effects of child poverty and, in some cases, on addressing the causes. We don't really have any region-wide plan or any kind of coordinating body. If you or I had a great idea to address child poverty or found one in another city that we visited, and we wanted to know if it was already being tried in Pittsburgh, there's no place you can call to find out definitively. So we really just have a ton of things going on, but they're not unified or coordinated in any way, and there's no one really tasked with looking for workable, effective, proven solutions elsewhere that we might try here.
The Annie E. Casey Foundation recently found that Pennsylvania is one of 10 states where the percentage of kids living in high poverty areas has actually increased. Your recent reporting outlines 20 solutions already being pursued, as you alluded to, at the local or state level, and some even abroad. Which stand out most to you?
You hate to kind of look at our cross-state rival, but Philadelphia, a couple of years ago, instituted a tax on sweet drinks. And essentially, they're raising about $77 million a year by taxing everything from soda to those super sweet energy drinks and even the highly sweetened juice drinks, and in order to pay for stuff that helps kids in difficult neighborhoods, improving early education, improving schools, libraries, recreation centers, parks. And the funny thing is, in addition to raising money for that, it has reduced the consumption of these super sweet drinks, which arguably is kind of good for kids, too. So that's one that I thought was intriguing.
So that was enacted by the mayor, the council, or was that done on a ballot measure?
No, that was done by mayor and council, and it survived numerous legal challenges and some intense lobbying from beverage makers that wanted to get rid of it. And now, right, it is resulting in investments in neighborhoods. It hasn't really been copied widely yet, and no one else in Pennsylvania has tried it yet.
Right. You mentioned Allegheny County voters last year rejected a property tax increase for early learning after school programs. It seemed there was a lot of ambiguity over who would oversee the funding and how programs would be selected to receive the grants.
Yeah, some of that wasn't specified in the ballot initiative, and I think that was a purposeful move by the folks who were pushing for that initiative. Things like that, children's funds, have been implemented in a lot of cities, and we took a close look at the one that is in place in Seattle, a small property tax increase. I think it raises something like $52 million a year that they've spent on largely programs for kids in challenged neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. Something like 30 cities or counties have children's funds. And as I'm sure your listeners know, the county executive, Rich Fitzgerald, has set up a working group that's looking at ways to fund early childhood education and after-school programs. And we're waiting for their report, which should come out any week now.
I just want to ask you about one more. Across the Pennsylvania-Ohio border in Cincinnati, they're addressing health care in schools. How so?
Yeah, folks with particularly entry-level jobs have and doing shift work might have a really difficult time getting the time to go to school, pick up the kid, bring the kid to the dentist, or bring the kid to the doctor. Heck, you might lose your job, or you might have a difficult time scheduling such appointments if you're working in many entry-level and shift jobs. So Cincinnati's public schools put medical and, in some cases, dental and vision clinics right in 24 schools. The kid never has to leave school. That saves a lot of time in the classroom that would otherwise be taken, going down to the office and getting carted from school to the doctor and back. And they've even opened up some of those to members of the community who aren't students.
Briefly, anything like that happening here? I know some Pittsburgh Public Schools officials visited Cincinnati a few years back.
This does not appear to be happening in any of the kind of classic public school districts that we're aware of in the region. Propel Schools has a version of this on the medical side. They don't have the dental or vision side at one of their locations. But so far, it hasn't caught on in the big districts.
Mm-hmm. Rich, what are any of these solutions going to take? Political will, investment?
I think leadership. There are some communities from Louisville to Glasgow in Scotland that have really embraced reduction of child poverty as an extremely important civic goal. They put it front and center. They put in the resources. They've demanded accountability and they've demanded results. We can grab any of these 20 solutions and a foundation and a nonprofit could set it up. But really, until there's leadership that's kind of dedicated to addressing this as a priority, it's hard to see making a dent in the fact that we have many communities in which half the kids are in poverty.
So childhood poverty is an issue you and some of your colleagues, Katie Amorisi, Stephanie Strasberg, and others have been focusing on for an extended period. What questions are you still exploring? And briefly, what if somebody has a suggestion?
Well, in the coming months, we're going to be taking a look at what happens when a community just really dedicates itself and its resources to addressing this problem. So expect some reporting on the ground from elsewhere on that front shortly. But we are continuing to update this list of solutions. So if someone knows of something that's working elsewhere that they think might be imported here, then we will explore it and we will put it out there.
And we'll have a link to that list on our website, WESA.FM. Rich Lord is an investigative reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Rich, we appreciate you making the time.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, a conversation with screenwriter, author, and Pittsburgher Stephen Chbosky on his latest novel, Imaginary Friend. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit WESA.FM/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Christopher Stubbs. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.